Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we will be talking with novelist, playwright, and filmmaker Cici Dangaramba. She's from Zimbabwe, and she currently is spending some time in residence today and tomorrow at the Krenner Center. Two of her films will be shown. I'll tell you about that in just a moment, but let me tell you a little bit more about her. Her first novel was Nervous Conditions, and that was published in 1988. It won the Commonwealth Writers Prize and got a lot of positive attention. It was, in fact, the first novel to be published in English by a black Zimbabwean woman. In 1996, she became the first Zimbabwean woman to direct a feature film, that film Everyone's Child. And that is a film that you can see here on the U of I campus in the Studio Theater at the Krannert Center tonight at 7 o'clock. Her second, a film called Mother's Day, was featured at Sundance in 2005, and that movie will be shown tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Studio Theater, and she'll be there for a question and answer period afterwards to talk about her film and her work. She is here visiting the campus and visiting with us, and we're very pleased to have her here in the studio to talk about her writing and her work. Questions are certainly welcome as we move through this hour. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, so if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number, and the call's on us, and that is 800-222-9455, so 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David.
It seems, as I read about you, that you have a very strong drive, a very strong desire to tell African stories. And I don't know if they're particularly Zimbabwean stories, but African stories particularly. What kind of stories really engage you and make you want to write plays or make movies?
Well, that's really one of the things I have to ask myself from time to time. And I think it goes back to being at school and really only reading the English greats from the 19th century and before, Shakespeare, Jane Austen, you name it. And I never saw myself in these narratives. And for me at that time, I didn't realize why that was, that there is a systematic reason for voices such as mine not appearing in literature. And so quite naively, I think, I decided I would rectify that. And I thought, well, if no one's done it up until now, let me give it a try. And that's how I really started writing.
Mm-hmm. And you really, now, I know that when you were at university, you did some playwriting and then after that wrote this novel. And but I think that you really had been writing since you were small or well, younger than at college age, at least.
Absolutely. I would say I began at school, and really it began with school essays. I really would put everything I had into the school essays. I listened to my teachers, and they told me to write about things that I knew well, so I did that. And I enjoyed the process. I enjoyed reading other people's literature, and I enjoyed creating worlds, describing them. I also enjoyed getting feedback about my writing when people told me that what I had written had moved them, touched them in some way, made them feel better, made them understand things better that maybe they hadn't thought about. And I think I did begin to recognize that writing is some kind of a gift. Not everybody can do that. It's like singing, any kind of art or any kind of ability. And I was very grateful to have this gift. So, yes, I started writing at school, won competitions and so forth. And at university, I started writing more seriously. I had time in which to do that, and there was quite a dynamic arts movement at the University of Zimbabwe when I was there in the 80s. And that's when I became involved with theatre and decided to write some plays again. I was a member of the university theatre group, but there were not many roles for women, specifically for black women. So I thought, let me write some, and that's how I began writing drama.
Yeah. I think I also read you said something like when you started writing, and maybe even now, there weren't a lot of women writers, so there would not have been a lot of role models for you as a young woman wanting to be a writer. Was that something that would have been important, or did it not matter to you that there weren't other women that you could point to and say, here's someone that shows me that I can do this too?
At that time, when I was younger, I used to jump before I looked. And so I'd sort of be like in deep water and then realize, oh dear, I need a role model, and then start looking for the role model. Luckily, by the time I was writing, I was able to look across the Atlantic, of course, to this continent, to Maya Angelou, to Alice Walker, and then to Toni Morrison. And at that time, it was possible to get that kind of literature in Zimbabwe, so that was immensely helpful. And I also felt that, well, if sisters are doing it across the ocean, then I can do it here. So that was really useful for me.
Yeah. So you were born in Zimbabwe. Actually, it wasn't Zimbabwe, and then it was still Rhodesia when you were born there. And when you were two, I think I have this right, your family moved to England. So you lived there until you were six, then went back to Rhodesia, and then went back to university at Cambridge, and then went back. So you have gone back and forth really a number of times. Were there times when you felt like you really weren't quite sure who you were, where you were living? Did that give you some reason to ask questions about identity and what that was all about?
In a way, yes, and in another way, no. My experience in England was that I didn't live with my parents for very long. We went to foster parents because both my parents were studying, and my mother felt she needed the space in order to study and wouldn't be able to look after myself and my brother, and then later on my sister. So I was raised with foster parents for about 3 out of the 4 years that I was in England. And coming back to Zimbabwe, it was very wonderful for me because it was a chance to have the family back together again. So, well, Rhodesia as it was at that time. So I always associated that part of the world with home, with family, with what I really was. Of course, having spent that time outside of the country, I did have different influences, and that did mean that I looked at things in a different way from a young person who had not been out of the country. But I think I have always seen that as an advantage, as an opportunity to expand my consciousness, to know more about the world, rather than as a disadvantage. This is not to say that there were no problems. Of course, there were problems, because sometimes my behavior would not be as expected. But I also feel that that's also my personality. I think if I had stayed in Zimbabwe, my behavior still would not have been as expected.
Meaning not what would be expected for a girl or for a woman?
Both. I mean, as a girl then and as a woman now.
Mm. Well, that's one of the themes, an important theme, certainly in Nervous Conditions. That is the idea of challenging the expected or received roles for women. Who does it? Why do they do it? And maybe something of what the consequences are. Is that something that particularly interests you as a writer?
Absolutely. I do feel it is an important question. And although I wrote Nervous Conditions nearly 2 decades ago, I do think that the questions are still pertinent. And I think the questions are pertinent not only to Zimbabwe. Nervous Conditions has been read almost all over the world, and as far as Sweden and Australia, even on this continent, people come up to me today still and say, gosh, I can identify with that. So I do think this whole issue of who may do what because of what biological categorization is an important question. And unfortunately, in my mind, Zimbabwe has not progressed as far as one would have wished. Legally, there are lots of opportunities for women, but the practice, the social practice, is still quite restrictive. I think we are making some progress, but it is very difficult to change people's minds. And this isn't only the men. The women still are very chauvinistic in their attitudes towards other women. So the progress has been slow. But as I say, in Zimbabwe, I always meet young women who come up and say, look, Siti, I've made something of myself, and it was your book that told me that I can be something. So I think every individual success is part of the process.
Yeah. As you say, the book, as I mentioned at the beginning, the book won the Commonwealth Writers Prize, and a lot of people have said that they liked and appreciated it, and I know it's been translated into a number of languages, and so that's a significant success for any kind of a writer. You wrote that book. It was published. You were only 25. Did that kind of success at that point, did that make a big difference in your life?
Very interesting question. what my experience has been, or what I have come to think as a result of my experience, is that opportunity really does need to come at a particular point. It can come too early and it can come too late. In my case, I had written that book when I was 25, but I was not able to publish it for several years simply because I could not find a publisher in Zimbabwe. I remember receiving rejections from a number of publishing houses, and one of them told me that they'd sent it out to readers, and the readers had come back and said that the book just rambled all over the place and didn't have a theme, etc., etc. Suffice it to say that these were male readers. And also, this was just after independence in the mid-80s, and there were also many black male editors and readers, and surely subconsciously they must have been reacting to the black feminist message in the book. I met one of the editors recently, and I reminded him of that letter that he wrote to me, and he denied it vehemently. And he told me that he had said I should come and see him, and they would continue to consider, which wasn't true at all, because it turns out that it's the same publishing house as the one that published my play later on. So if there had been any desire to publish that novel, that publishing house would have done it. And it's interesting how people decide to deny some of the things that they do. I also think that this is one reason why we do not progress as much as we do. If people could at least admit and talk about certain decisions that they made and how maybe they have moved away from that kind of decision, I think this would help progress in the society. So for me, I do believe that the success of that novel came a bit late. It took 4 years to have it published, and so by the time that process was set in motion, it was like 5 years since I had written it. And when you're 25, 5 years is a long time. I had moved on to other things. I'd done my degree, and I was beginning to become interested in film. I had told myself that I should not continue wanting a career as a writer, trying to make a living as a writer. Obviously, my family had not been very supportive at that time, and I cannot really blame them. If you looked around Zimbabwe, there were no people who were actually making a living as a writer. Most of the editors I've mentioned were also writers at the time, which again left room for competition and professional jealousy. And so I did go into film. And by the time the book came out, I had decided to go and study film in Germany. And I actually found that the process of writing and creating for film was quite different from the process of writing and creating literature prose. And I decided I would have to not return to literature until I had mastered the craft of film. So it was a double-edged sword for me. Indeed, I think that very early success might not have been what was good for me, because I do believe in the maturation process. And but on the other hand, I think that sometimes success can delay a bit too long.
Yeah. Our guest, Tsitsi Dangaremba, she's a Zimbabwean novelist, playwright, filmmaker. She's spending some time at the Kranert Center in residence. Two were for films, Everyone's Child and Mother's Day, will be shown, one tonight, one tomorrow afternoon. You also can go out and look for her first novel, Nervous Conditions, that was published in 1988. And in fact, a sequel, The Book of Not, was published last year, 2006. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just before going on and talking some more about writing and filmmaking, you for a time were a med student, right, at Cambridge. What influenced your decision to study medicine and then to give that up and go back home? And then you went to university and studied psychology, and then you really got much more serious into writing.
Okay. I think that's quite often a normal... That's often quite a normal career path, I think, for an artist, and that one tries this and that until one finds what one really wants to do. But I will tell you this, and I have not admitted this in public before in my life, but one of the reasons why I wanted to study medicine is that this all happened while the liberation struggle, the war of liberation, was going on in Zimbabwe. This was at the end of the 70s. And my dream had been to actually become a doctor and go into the camps and serve there, because while I was at school, I went to a multiracial school, which basically at that time was a school of perhaps 300 white girls and 5 black girls or so. there were quotas which were regulated by the Zimbabwean government, the Rhodesian government as it was then, as to how many black people could actually associate with white people in these schools. And I was one of these few black people. And while I was there, the war intensified, and the black girls at these schools would often get together and talk about the war and the moral implications of killing people for whatever reason, and whether one felt oneself that one would be able to cross the border into Mozambique and take up arms and come back and fight against people that you were actually at school with. So this was a moral issue that I was very much concerned with. And while, of course, the majority of people in Zimbabwe supported that liberation struggle, it was clear to some of us that actually taking a life was probably not the way one wanted to fight it. And so to resolve that dilemma, to contribute to the struggle in some way, I thought I'd become a doctor and at least just treat the people who were wounded as a result of the struggle. That was in the late 70s. That's when I went to Cambridge also. And, of course, the war came to an end in 79 with the Lancaster House Agreement between the Zimbabwe Liberation Forces and the government of Zimbabwe Rhodesia, as it was called then, which was led by Mr. Smith. And my dream fell away with the peace. So there was no reason for me to continue to want to study medicine. And so I thought, well, let me go home then and see what's actually happening and see how I can participate in the new process of creating Zimbabwe.
We have a caller here to talk with. Let's bring them into the conversation. And other people are listening, by the way. That's certainly welcome. We'd like to talk with our guest, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And caller here is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I was curious about something you said about your schooling. You said you hadn't ever seen yourself represented in world literatures. And judging by the dates, I'm just surprised because African literature was very popular, at least here in the United States, by the time you were going to school, like Chinua Achebe, Flora Nwapa, and you know, Woye Soyinka. And there's a whole group of South African writers that were very popular. So I'm just wondering if it was because of your particular course of study that you hadn't read these books, or just you know, how did that happen?
Thank you. I'm really happy to clarify on that point. And indeed, yes, you do have the right answer there. It was because of the curricula that existed in the Rhodesian schools at that time. I think the curriculum that I studied was very definitely an English curriculum. We wrote exams that were marked in England, so they were following the English canon. I was lucky in a way that I had these novels that you mention at home, because my parents were educated people, and that is how I could actually see that there was a lack in the curriculum, because I would go home and see that this literature existed and go to school and see that it did not exist in school. However, having said that, most of the African literature that you have mentioned deals with male children. I think when I was young, I only read one that had a memorable female character for me, and that was Kamare Laye's The African Child.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to watching your film this evening. Thank you.
All right. Again, thank you for the call, and others who would like to call in are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So after having done some writing for theater, writing plays, and writing this novel, what was it that got you interested in making films?
Well, film was becoming quite a medium. There was talk about it at the time that I was at the University of Zimbabwe. And actually, the government was discussing how one could make use of the art in the project of nation building. And the conclusion that the government was coming to at that time was that drama is what would be used for that project, because of the agitprop characteristics that you could easily manipulate for that purpose. And the government went into setting up a community theatre project in the whole country, which was actually very successful. However, I was aware that everybody watched television, everybody wanted to go to the cinema if they had access to it, and that this was another medium that was going to be very powerful. At the same time that the government was setting up its community theatre projects, other people who had been out of the country during the liberation struggle, who had acquired skills in film production, were coming into the country and setting up projects as well. And so when I was not able to pursue my career in literature immediately, I realized that this was another option for me. I had been writing for the stage while I was on campus, and so I see myself more as someone who tells stories, a producer of diverse kinds of narrative. And so for me, it didn't really matter that much where I situated myself in that whole area of narrative, as long as I could contribute to telling the right kinds of stories. Very luckily for me, one of the first projects I got into was really interesting and confirmed my desire to use this medium as a means of telling stories that had not been heard before. Because I ended up working for a video company that did development-oriented videos. And one of the first projects was something on the land reform that was going on in the 1980s in Zimbabwe. And I was asked to be the research assistant for that. And it was amazing to go through the whole country and see the different projects of land reform that were taking place. There were private ones, rather run by the government. There were reform programs run by the churches, run by NGOs, all different kinds. And the idea was to just show people what was happening in land reform in the 1980s. And I met some amazing characters, and that really confirmed my interest in this medium as a form of narrative.
So how was it that you ended up going to Germany, to the German Film and Television Academy in Berlin?
It was just one of those things that happened. I decided I wanted to get training. Having worked in this video production house for several months, I decided I wanted to get training so I could do my job better. And I started inquiring as to the kinds of film schools that might be more in the direction that I wanted to go, which was not mainstream, which was telling stories that hadn't been told, which was playing with the medium to... playing with the medium to try and find a way of expressing a Zimbabweanness in the medium. And my inquiries led me to possibilities such as Cuba, Australia, and Germany. London also was said to be very good, but I realized that I wouldn't have the money to go there. So off I went to the Cuban embassy and said, I want to go to film school in Cuba. And of course, the Cuban men there laughed at me. They were very kind and courteous, but they did laugh at me all the same. So I thought, okay, well, that's not going to work. And the Australian, I can't remember. I think I did receive some information from them. But a friend of mine worked at the German volunteer service. And so she put me in touch with some German people there. And they confirmed that the school in Berlin was one of the best schools for what I was looking for. And they said I should apply. So I never thought that I couldn't do anything at that stage in my life. So I applied. I didn't realize that they got about 600 applications a year and only took 20 people. I couldn't speak German at all. And so my first round of applications was translated by these friends at the German volunteer service. And I was invited to the entrance exam. And I thought, oh, my goodness, now, you know, what am I going to do? They won't be there to translate for me during the exam. How am I going to manage? Nevertheless, I bought my ticket and I took a 2-week crash course in German, about 5 hours a day. And I bought a dictionary and off I went with my dictionary and myself, and strangely enough, I was selected. The German film industry at that point had a very good revival plan, in my opinion. The idea was to bring foreign creative people into Germany to interact with young future filmmakers in order to inspire them, you know, to expand their creativity. And so there actually was a quota for foreign students. Having said that, many foreign students did apply, so I was very lucky to be selected, and that's how I ended up at film school.
Yeah. And how many years then did you live in Germany?
I lived in Germany for quite a while, from 1989 until 2000. The course was meant to be about 5 years long, but it became longer for me because of my language problem. So it did take me a couple of years longer to complete that course. And during the course of that time, I met my husband and we got married and started having children. So my idea had been to return to Zimbabwe as soon as I'd finished the course and become involved in the industry there. But now with children and a family, that became different. And I waited until 2000 to return to Zimbabwe. I don't know if I would have returned in 2000 if the political situation in Zimbabwe had not become critical at that time. What actually happened is that I was still in Germany. I had finished my studies and I was working on small projects here and there, mainly documentary. And at that time, there was a lot of coverage of the political situation in Zimbabwe, specifically from June 2000, when a new wave of land invasions took place. And I was very disturbed by the nature of the reporting in the German media. And so I told my husband I needed to be at home so I could see for myself whether what was being reported was true or not. So that's how I went back to Zimbabwe in 2000. I needed something big to overcome the inertia of simply sitting and continuing to stay in Germany. And actually the land invasions provided that for me.
We're at our midpoint here, just a bit past. Cici Dangaremba is our guest. She's a Zimbabwean award-winning novelist, playwright, filmmaker. She's spending a couple of days in residence at the Kreinert Center here on the University of Illinois campus and is talking with us here about her work. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And people who are here in Champaign-Urbana can see two of her films, Everyone's Child and Mother's Day. Everyone's Child will be shown tonight at 7 in the Studio Theater, that's at the Kreinert Center, and then Mother's Day at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, and then she'll be there to talk about the film and her work, and these are all free and open to the public, so anyone who is interested in attending should certainly feel welcome. Perhaps you might talk with us a little bit about Everyone's Child. This is a film that deals with AIDS and is the story of a group of children that are orphaned when their parents die of the disease. What was it that made you want to deal with that theme?
This is something I'm going to deal with in a bit more depth tomorrow when I speak about creating Zimbabwe as an artist. And I begin with that because that's my preface to saying that Everyone's Child is not really an auteur film, as I use the term from my European experience, a film that I thought I really needed to make. This is a film that was made by a production house in Zimbabwe called Media for Development Trust. Media for Development Trust is actually an American organization run by Americans who came to Africa, beginning with Zimbabwe, to set up a production house that would look at development issues. And so it occupies a very specific place in the development of film in the country. And I began to work with Media for Development Trust before I went to Germany to study film. This was the second production house that I worked with. The first one that I mentioned earlier that was doing the documentaries on land reform was called Capricorn Video Unit. It still exists. And Media for Development Trust was the second company that I did some work with in Zimbabwe, but that was just as a freelancer. And I began work with Media for Development Trust when they asked me to write the story for one of their first productions called Neria, the story of a woman whose husband dies. She becomes a widow, and the husband's family, her in-laws, try to take all the property from her. Very typical story in Zimbabwe, in Africa. And the idea was to educate women about their rights because the laws had been changed to enable African women to maintain and retain some of their property in the case of being widowed. So that was how I got to know Media for Development Trust. That was around 1988 that I wrote the story for them. When I went to Germany, they stayed in touch with me, and I did a lot of work for them, consultancy services on most of their films. And then in 1995, they asked me if I would like to direct Everyone's Child. Now, that was a major challenge for me because one of the reasons I had decided I wanted to produce narrative about my country and the part of the world that I knew, is that I felt that a lot of the images that were being put out about my country were really not what we as Africans would consider the most important or even the most representative of what we are. And so when I was asked to do an AIDS narrative, an HIV narrative, although, of course, I did realize that this is a critical issue, I felt that I did not want to get involved and be part of the AIDS industry and peddle those images of HIV and sickness in Africa, in my country, when there's so much health, there's so much that's living and vibrant. I was thinking, why can't I tap into these issues and distribute these images about my country? That would be healthier for us as Africans to acknowledge what is positive about ourselves and to put that out as a role model, something that we can aspire to, rather than all these negative images. However, I did not have much work. And I did want to direct a film, and I had worked with MFD for many years since before then. And so I decided that I would do it. I thought that my challenge would be to make this a story that really touched people at the human level, that went beyond stereotypes of illness and lack and inability and need to really say that, okay, HIV is another challenge and we can overcome it. And so I agreed to do that, and that's how I came to be involved in that particular production.
Mm-hmm. The other film, Mother's Day, that's going to be shown tomorrow afternoon, is that right? Yeah, Tuesday afternoon at 4 in the Studio Theater, and then you'll be talking about that. This, I read that this is actually based on a story, a childhood story or something, a story you remember being told by your mother? Is that right?
Absolutely. Not by my mother, though, but by my grandmother.
Oh.
Yes. Now, the interesting thing is that I had wanted to include that story in Everyone's Child. In Everyone's Child, there's a scene where a grandmother sits around a fire and tells her grandchildren a folk tale. And in my original version, the folk tale had been this particular story, which we call Simbimbino in Shona. Mm-hmm. And when the producers read the script, they thought it was not appropriate. And this is a story that I had been told as a child by my grandmother, and it had stayed with me for such a long time because it was such a powerful story. It's the story of a man in my part of the world who, during a time of drought, eats his wife. And for me, it was very symbolic of the challenges that African women and women of color have to face in the world, basically to avoid being eaten, using that figuratively, of course, to avoid being devoured, to stay whole, to stay together, as it were. So I had always been interested. I thought it was also a great challenge to represent that visually. How could you do it? And in my time at film school, I had also become interested in the sources of narrative. If one wanted to differentiate oneself from Bollywood or Nollywood or Hollywood, how would one do it? And one of the ways that I thought one might be able to do that is to go back to older sources for material, because our lives are converging. The lifestyle of most people in Zimbabwe is not very different in content from the lifestyle here. Okay, the quality of the content might be different, but the actual generality of it is not that different. I mean, even in the rural areas now, people have these small televisions and 12-volt car batteries, and they watch television. So I was thinking, okay, how am I now going to create a cinematic narrative that is specifically Zimbabwean? And then it occurred to me that one can go back to the old stories. And, of course, I'd seen this happening, like with the Asian, the cinematic movements. And so I thought that, you know, I would try to do that. And that's how I came to Mother's Day. And I'm very glad that I did, because I think it is the right direction.
I know I've read some things about your feeling, and I'm sure that there are other people who feel the same thing, that it's to build a homegrown film industry in Zimbabwe and get films shown is not an easy thing. And I came across an article where you had some fairly critical things to say last year about the film festival there and the fact that there weren't showing any films by Zimbabwean filmmakers at the Zimbabwean National Film Festival. Is it difficult to in your own country to get your films seen and shown?
To be honest, I can't really remember what I said, and I do think that the Zimbabwe International Film Festival does its best to screen local films, but I think there are several challenges there. First of all, we are not making that many films. In fact, nobody has shot on film since 2003 with Legend of the Sky Kingdom, to my knowledge, and I am aware of most of what's going on, the big events that are going on. So that was 2003, the last production to be shot on film. They might even have shot in 2002 because it was released in 2003. Now, I shot Mother's Day in 2003, and we shot on Beta, not even Digi, mm-hmm. but SP, because that's what we had available. And we then blew up to 35 millimeter. From my time in Germany and my husband's contacts, we had contacts in Switzerland who are very good at blow up at Swiss effects, and so we were able to get that done really professionally in Germany. And sometimes people actually think that we shot on film, but we didn't. So that is the level that the industry is operating at in Zimbabwe. Nollywood has been a mixed blessing. I think it has shown Zimbabwean people that you can have a cinema that speaks to your own people, or at least a moving images industry that speaks to your own people, that is viable. But then there are all the questions about the quality and the production values of Nollywood. I remember speaking about this to a colleague once who told me, Sitsi, he was in Nigeria once. I don't know how true this is, but this is what he said to me. He said he was in Nigeria once and he saw one person at a crossroads shooting four films. So the camera would point in one direction and shoot one scene at this film and then point in the next direction. Might have been an exaggeration, but I do think it portrays something about the nature of how Nollywood films are produced, and that how if they are produced in that way, then that is going to be visible in the final product. So I do think that the advent of Nollywood has tended to make Zimbabweans not very interested in the quality of the production. And I also think that this is the problem with other formats. With film being so expensive, you have to know what you're doing. You have to be certain that you're going to get the right product out there when you finish. Whereas with video, you buy your little camcorder, you press a button and you get some pictures and you put those together and you say, I've made a film. Whereas maybe what you've just done is put some pictures together. So this is the level we're at in Zimbabwe. And one of my interests is to try and instill some notion of quality. I think Zimbabweans are also not aware of the need for intense development work in projects. I often tell them of a friend of mine in Germany who has a production house and who got quite a sum of money for the state for over a period of 3 years simply to develop three projects. In Zimbabwe, people hardly develop projects. That people will go onto set and ad lib, and this is not trained people who can do that. I mean, look at Mike Lee. Of course, he improvises a lot, but the improvisation takes ages until people are sure that it's correct. So I do think we have a lot of moving images activity in Zimbabwe, but we can't even talk about an industry, and I don't even think we can talk about a business because people are not able to make a livelihood from it. I'm able to survive because I do the writing and I do the film work, and my husband is also an editor and he freelances. So we just about manage to keep our heads above water. We also have a very supportive family in Germany, and my family in Zimbabwe did finally come round to the fact that I was going to be a producer of narrative and became supportive as well. So I can't really blame the film festivals in Zimbabwe because we simply don't have the content. So what happens is that film festivals now have a choice. Are they going to show this content that's being produced that no other film festival in the world would research show, simply to say, look, we do have Zimbabwean activity in the medium? Or are they going to say that, you know, this is probably not the standard that should be shown at a festival? Now, this is a question that we have different answers to. My personal position is that I'm not going to screen substandard material. Other people take a different position and say, look, we've got to show people what people are doing. So that is one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is that we only have one television station, one television channel in Zimbabwe, and that is a national television station, which is state-owned. And so there is no competition as far as product is concerned, and they do not have money to pay people for productions anyway. People actually have to pay them to have their production screened on television very often. And also that depends on who is actually at the head at that point in time. And so what I feel is that those people who are really concerned about the medium and producing good quality material do not want to have to pay a television station to accept their material. I think people who are in the business for a different reason would probably pay the television station to screen their material. So there are lots of things that are working to make it difficult to produce high quality material. I do a lot of training, a lot of workshops in Zimbabwe as well. I have an organization that I belong to called Women Filmmakers of Zimbabwe, and this is more of a development organization. My experience in that organization has been when you take people and you give them the space to sit down and understand why one has to do it this way and not that, why one has to think about one's character, develop this part of the script and that part of the script, people are receptive to it. So I think it's a question of time. I think it's also a question of patience on the part of people who have the skills, and also some commitment to passing these skills on to the next generation. And if we can do that, then I think that we will start to produce material. What I have noticed is that when I screen my productions, people do react to them, and they do realize that the quality is higher than the quality of a lot of local productions. And I try to give people something to aspire to say, look, you know, you can do this too. It just takes a bit of training. All I had was training as well. Another success that I feel I've had is that when Mother's Day came out in Zimbabwe, it actually was screened on television. And I do have to say, at that time, I didn't have to pay. But since then, things have changed, and so my later productions with the women's group have not been screened. But at that time, my productions were being screened, and people would call me up and say, gosh, Siti, I saw that film, but I know that film. It's the Simbimbino story. I said, yes, it is. They said, what? So are you actually allowed to retell the old stories? I said, wow, you've got it.
You mean you had to have, they thought you had to have permission, or it was something, somehow the idea was that it had to be a new story, a traditional story somehow? You just weren't supposed to do that?
Well, I think it's a question of how one sees one's Africanness. Do you see your Africanness as something that is permissible in today's world, you know, or do you have to be modernized out of your Africanness? But to actually say, I can go back and take some things with me that might even enrich my life today as a modern, postmodern African, is something that I think a lot of people had not thought about. Mm.
I want to try to get a caller in here. We have about 5 minutes left. Cece Dangarama is our guest. She's a filmmaker, novelist, playwright from Zimbabwe, spending a couple of days here on the U of I campus. Her films will be shown, and before the end of the show, I'll tell you one more time how you can see them. Let's talk with someone in Champaign here, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have two questions for your guest. Your guest mentioned the importance of African-American writers in her development as a writer, women like Toni Morrison and Alice Walker. And I was wondering if she could elaborate on how the Western country sanctions against Zimbabwe has affected the next generation of Zimbabwean novelists, playwriters, and directors. And then my second question really is about her second novel. It is not easily available here in the United States, and I wondered why not and how we can actually get a copy. Thank you.
All right.
Okay, that again I think is a very important question to look at. My personal opinion is that sanctions have impacted very negatively on all areas of artistic endeavor in Zimbabwe. one of the big areas in which this impact is felt is that one simply cannot access material from other parts of the world. I've been talking about the kinds of productions that are made in Zimbabwe in film, and this also happens in literature, that we have a lot of people who really want to say something but don't have the tools. And how can you improve your art if you cannot see what other great artists are doing? And so this has had a very serious impact on Zimbabwean artistic production. To the second question, it is a pity that it is difficult to find the Book of Not in this part of the world. And I do hope that that situation will be rectified shortly.
I don't know. Does that get at your question, caller?
Yes, thank you.
All right, thanks. Something I want to get back to, because you were talking about the film industry as it is in Zimbabwe and the difficulty people have in perhaps either making films or getting them shown. I one of the things I understand is you actually have a script that you want to shoot for another film, and that at least as of about a year or so ago, you couldn't find the money to do it. Is that still the case?
That is still the case. When Mother's Day was so successful, I decided to develop a series of three films so that I could put them together and have a 90-minute feature-length production based on folklore. So I now have the two stories that would complete that project. And since Mother's Day came out, I really have not been able to get production funds for anything, which is really surprising considering that it's one of the best films that have come out of the Southern African region in the last 5 years or so.
Mm-hmm. So that's really it's tough. If you're a writer, I suppose at least you can produce the work, and as you say, though, getting it published is something else entirely. But to make a film, even a film on a very low budget, I think I read that you were looking for about 400,000 euros, which, you know, depending on by contemporary Hollywood standards or Bollywood or films made in Africa, that's not a whole lot of money. But 400,000 euros is 400,000 euros. That's what it was that you were thinking that you would need?
That's what I thought I would need, and I haven't been able to raise a cent for it.
Yeah. Well, we're coming down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. I guess I'm interested again as we come around to the end here to have you talk a little bit more about just the kinds of stories that you would really like to be telling. For example, the you were talking about here that you would like to do this triptych, this three-part film, with Mother's Day being one and then being other two parts. What are the other stories that are here that you want to tell?
Well, I do think that cinema requires extremely dramatic subject matter, and I do think that folklore provides this fairy tales. I mean, there's all the gore and people do terrible things to each other and miraculous things happen, but all in a removed context so that one doesn't have to be too terribly shocked about it. And so I have one story about a serpent goddess that lives in the Zambezi River in the north of Zimbabwe. And I always say that this being is related to the Loch Ness Monster. This is a goddess that would come out during times of drought and lay itself down so that villagers could eat of it and survive. So I have a story based on that. And then I have another story, which is light this time, because I do realize that the first two stories are quite dark. The last story that I have has got two variations in the folklore, and it's basically about a man who wants to get married and cannot find a wife, and he prays to his ancestors and is told how to do it. There are two ways. The first time he has to make a doll and leave it by the river, and the doll comes to life, and the second time he has to make a mortar for pounding grain and leave that, and the next day this mortar has turned into a beautiful woman. But in both cases, he is told that there's a taboo he must not break. In terms of the mortar, he's told that the woman must not pound. In other words, treat your wife well, you know, don't overwork her. And in the second one, he's also told that his wife may not go out while it's raining. because this doll is made of mud. And again, it's the same principle, treat your wife well. And of course, he breaks the taboo in both cases. And so in my version, the idea is to leave it open. He's actually given a third chance, and the question is, has he learned anything? So that's quite a lighthearted one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sort of lighthearted, I guess, with obviously a very serious kind of way of looking at, feminist way of looking at the world underlying it. How do men react to your work?
That's really interesting. I remember meeting a colleague a couple of months ago, not that long ago, and he said to me, "Titi, what is it with your films? Is it your training? Is it your feminism? What is it?" So I felt that at least, you know, what I was trying to get over is getting home. First of all, he's looking at the training. He's beginning to realize that if you want to make something work, you have to have the skills, and you've got to take time to learn those skills. And I took 7 years to do it and sacrificed my literary career for 7 years. And then the second thing that I think he picked up in that is that you have to have a position. You can't just go out there and start throwing your pictures together without carefully considering from what position you want this narrative to come from. And I think most people in Zimbabwe at the moment have taken what I would call the development position. I spoke about the development films that I did with Media for Development Trust. And in my personal opinion, I think that has not been the best thing for creative narrative in Zimbabwe, because the development position, it's not about engaging hearts. It's about telling people things. It's about information. And so, again, that's something that I'm trying to make people understand, is that you can get your message across best by engaging a person's heart, by making what you want to say hit them powerfully. Mm. And that's where I'm at the moment in my work.
Well, there we will have to finish one more time. We'll say that if you're interested in seeing the two films that we've talked about, Everyone's Child will be shown at the Studio Theater at the Kranert Center tonight at 7, and then Mother's Day tomorrow afternoon at 4, also in the Studio Theater. And our guest, Tsitsi Dangaremba, would be there to talk about the film and about her work. She's here spending 2 days in residence at the Kranert Center. Also, you can look for her novel, Nervous Conditions, published in 1988. And if you can find it, the sequel, The Book of Not, published in 2006. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.